All right, so as I have in our plenary session, I've told you, and if you weren't there, I apologize, and I'll let you know again. But I'm in the process of moving, and so we left our house in about 45 minutes south of Pittsburgh in the Mon Valley, and David knows. David was my youth pastor and been in our house many times, and we loved the house, and we loved life there. You know, one of the things we did is we started a rowing team for at-risk youth in the Mon Valley, and we're combining them with mentors and morphed into as well an adult rowing team. And so my wife had never rowed before, so she learned how to row, and three times a week we'd go and we'd row on the Mon River, which had never had rowing shells on it in the history of the world before. And we just had a great time. But one of the things we really loved there was our house. We moved in. It was just kind of a sort of a plain rancher. But my wife likes remodeling, and it used to be the case that she liked to watch me do remodeling, but she actually started doing some of the work. But we remodeled our kitchen, and then we remodeled our dining room, and we remodeled the bathroom, and then we remodeled the sunroom, and we built built-ins, and we added a wood stove, and we just did work throughout the whole house. And we were there for about 2.5 years. And so in the first 2 weeks of this month was kind of furious packing, and in the middle of all that, there was this moment of quiet, and she said to me, and moving is hard, and it's hard emotionally, and it's hard physically, and all of those things. And she said to me, you know, I love this house, but the thing I'm going to miss, really, is about this house is you. It's your fingerprint, and it's the way you think about building projects and the way things should look. And as I walk around the house, I see you. And that's what I'm mostly going to miss about this house. So it was an interesting thing that she said that, and it resonated with me. And but I want to say something. If Summer went back to that house, and it's sold now, and she went up to one of the counters and she kind of lovingly wiped it, or she painted a bookshelf, I would have no idea that she had done that, and it wouldn't affect me in the least, right? Because a house is an inanimate object. But what about a person, specifically somebody who is one of God's children? And so the thing I want to propose, the thesis I want to argue for you, is that as you love one of God's children, you actually love God. And moving it one step further, that as you grow in your love for God's people, you're actually growing in your love for God. And that those two things can't be separated. What I'm going to present is an overview, basically my introductory paragraphs and concluding paragraphs to the exegetical portion of the doctorate ministry program I'm in. And it's based in 1 John. So we're going to look at four passages. I probably I'm going to run way long, and so we may not get to all four, but I'm going to do my best to present them, and we'll just kind of go through them, and I'm going to slowly build the argument. And really, this argument is based completely in chapter 4 of 1 John. So I'm going to present 1 John 4, verses 7 and 8, but then I'm going to back up, and I'm going to present some background material from chapter 2 and chapter 3, and then I'm going to return to 1 John 4, and I'm going to conclude the rest of the chapter. And hopefully by then, I'll have done a good job and you will be convinced. But if you won't, that's okay. You let me know, and that will help me do a better job on this paper anyway. So 1 John 4:7 says, "Dear friends, let us love one another because love is from God, and everyone who loves has been fathered by God and knows God. And the one who does not love does not know God, because God is love." So a couple of things here. This is really important. Let us love one another because love is from God, and everyone who loves has been fathered by God and knows God. So there are two verbs that describe fathered by God and knows God, and they are different in their tense, the fathered by and knows, okay? Fathered is referring to an event in the past. Knows is something that is ongoing. The knows is the Greek word gnosko, and it has the idea of intimacy. And so what John is saying is somebody who loves, what you know about that person is that they were born again at some point in their past, and that they are in a state of knowing God, that they know Him, that there's intimacy in their walk with God. And so those two things, those are distinct verses or distinct verbs in verse 7. Verse 8, the person who does not love does not know God. John then goes to the second of those two verbs about knowing, and he says, if you're not loving the believers, then you're not knowing God. Or you can't be, if you don't have love for God's people, for God's children, then, man, you can't be claiming to be in a loving relationship with God, or to use one of John's terms, to be abiding with Him. I should have said this at the start, introductory information. I believe 1 John is about fellowship with God. That's the primary purpose. 1 John chapter 1, if you remember, I'm writing these things so that our fellowship will be with you and your fellowship with us, and our fellowship and our joy will be complete. In other words, we're going to have full joy in our relation, John's relationship with his audience and in the relationship with God. So if there's another predominant perspective on 1 John, and that's that 1 John is a litmus test for belief. So this is about, some people read it saying, well, if you do this, you're a believer, and if you don't, you're not. I don't think that's the case. I think John is written to believers, and it's John's attempt to say, hey, this is what walking with God looks like. This is what fellowship looks like. So we see that distinction in verse 7. He says, everyone who loves has been fathered by God. So the person who loves has been fathered by God and knows God, is knowing Him. The person who does not love does not know God, because God is love. All right, now I want to just make sure I'm not missing anything here as I go in my notes. All right, we'll keep moving. So without being connected to God, some implications from this passage, expressing Christian love is an impossibility. And at the same time, the converse is true. Being in close relationship with God requires the immediate demonstration of God's love to other believers. All right.
Ask a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Only to other believers or to other people?
So that's a very good question, and it's one that the passage and my talk requires being asked. I am not going to answer it, though, but what I will say is this. I'm going to specifically talk about believers. I do believe there are implications for the believer's relationship with unbelievers, but for the purposes of this talk and this paper, we're going to be talking about love for believers. I was going to save this till the end, but I'll put it in here at the start. So this all sounds great, and you know, we put love on the side of our buildings, and we love one another, and we sing songs about it and everything. But it's not nearly as simple as that. Has anyone you love been through a divorce that's been messy? So think about that. True story. Young kid, sexually abused by a predator in a church, and the pastor of the church goes to the hearing, the young boy's pastor, and the boy gives his testimony, and turns out the pastor's there to support the predator. What does love look like? So we think of love, and we think of our spouse, and we think of our favorite, you know, child or grandkid or whatever. But in that, I don't know if we're really getting what John's getting at. When you take love and you apply it in those circumstances, what changes is you. In other words, your self-perception, what you think of yourself, what you think of God, how you relate to Him, requires a massive shift away from things that are comfortable and into the realm of the supernatural, quite honestly. All right. So, opening information, God is love, and He's the initiator of love between believers. The love that believers demonstrate is of divine origin, supernatural in its nature. Let's go to second chapter of 1 John, verse 7. Dear friends, I'm not writing a new commandment to you, but an old commandment, which you've had from the beginning. The commandment is the word that you've already heard. On the other hand, I'm writing a new commandment to you, which is true in Him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. The one who says he is in the light but still hates his fellow Christian is in the darkness. The one who loves his fellow Christians resides in light. There's no cause for stumbling in him. But the one who hates his fellow Christian is in darkness, walks in the darkness, and does not know where he's going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. If God is love and believers are to express the love of God, then this passage is stating the converse of that, or this is the negative. The failure to love other believers indicates the failure to walk with God. Now, I know that's an implication that I've already made, but I'm going to be a little bit thorough as I go through this. So John makes strong statements. So a couple of things I want to point out to you. Verse 8, on the other hand, I'm writing a new that's new in quality. And so there's a new aspect, there's a new depth to the commandment which is true in you. The one who says he is in the light but hates his fellow Christian is still in darkness. So I've written that the exegetical portion covers all of these verses, but verse 9 is the heart of what I'm trying to get across. If you claim to be in the light, which we're going to treat as synonymous for in fellowship with God or abiding is John's term. By the way, why is abiding so important in the book of 1 John? Anyone have an idea why that John makes a big deal about abiding just quickly? John 15 is definitely the background. The key verse, I think, of the whole book is verse 28 of chapter 2. And now, little children, abide in him so that when he appears, we may have confidence and not shrink from him in shame at his coming. So why is abiding so important in the book of 1 John? It's because when Jesus comes back, John says there are going to be believers who are ashamed of the way they've lived. And so if you are concerned about that moment, the answer to that is to abide. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems like, okay, abide. What do I do with that? I think what I'm presenting here today is putting some meat on that principle. I think it means that you love people really, really well. That's, you love God really well to start, but how you understand that is that you look at the people around you and you can look at that. Am I being faithful in my expression of divine love to them? All right. That was out of place. I should not have gone there, but anyway, I did. So that's why abiding, that's why remaining, that's why being in the light, that's why all of this stuff is so important, because there's coming a day when we're going to stand before him. And we can either shrink away in shame or in confident joy look forward to it. All right. So the one who says he is in the light but still hates his fellow Christian is still in the darkness. The one who loves his fellow Christian resides in the light. So resides is our word meno. And there is no cause for stumbling in him. But the one who hates his fellow Christian is in darkness, walks in darkness, and does not know where he is going because darkness has blinded his eyes. This is strong condemnation for the believer who thinks they love God, but yet has this, we use this because he uses blind spot in certain arenas. You know, this parent never been able to forgive them for what they did, for how they failed in some arena, or this whatever, or that person, or... And the list goes on of people who we kind of feel it's acceptable for us to hate. Now, again, I'm trying to bring this into the realm of the church. And so maybe if that person's outside of the church, I'll let you deal with that another time. In other words, if they're not a believer, we'll deal with that separately. But if that person's a believer, everything changes. And John's words are really, really hard. They're really hard. I just had my text on them, and so I can't figure out how my notes and the PowerPoint don't work together, and so I had to pick one or the other, and I definitely want my notes. Okay, so the one shows failure indicates a failure to walk with God. In addition to this, the passage clarifies that a failure to love another believer is a step away from intimacy with God. Love for God grows as love for believers grow. Failure to move in love toward believers demonstrates movement away from intimacy with God. So that's hard, isn't it? All right, we'll get to our third passage. We'll go to chapter 3, verse 12. And don't be like Cain, who was of the evil one and brutally murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his deeds were evil, but his brothers were righteous. Therefore, do not be surprised, brothers and sisters, if the world hates you. We know that we have crossed over from death to life because we love our fellow Christians. The one who does not love remains in death. Everyone who hates his fellow Christian is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. We have come to know love by this, that Jesus laid down his life for us. Thus, we ought to lay down our lives for our fellow Christians. But whoever has the world's possessions and sees his fellow Christian in need and shuts off his compassion against him, how can the love of God reside in such a person? Again, another kind of strong passage. So let's set the context a little bit with Cain and Abel. It's a good illustration for John to pick because Cain and Abel were brothers. Now, that's not saying that Cain's a believer or Cain's going to be in heaven. I don't believe that, and I don't think John's saying that. But the illustration of intimacy fits. They're in the same family. By the way, was God absent from that scene? In other words, what was the setting that motivated murder? It was worship. It was both of the brothers in their relationship with God, right? The setting's worship for Cain and Abel and how that falls apart. And simply stated, Cain says, the text says that God was pleased with Abel and with his offering. There's two things God's pleased with. And God was displeased with two things, with Cain as a person and with Cain's offering. So there's a pleasure and a displeasure on two accounts on both sides of this equation. There's a commentary by James Boyce, who does a good job in Genesis chapter 4 with Cain's name, which seems to be derived from the Hebrew word kana, and it means to get or to acquire. If you read in Genesis 4, Eve makes this exclamation, behold, I've acquired a man, I've gotten him. And most translations say, with the help of the Lord. The with the help of is a poor translation of the Hebrew direct object indicator, And so with the help of, even in your NASB, will be translated in italics. It's really the only place it's translated with that. So then if you take that out, you get this, I've acquired a man, even the Lord. And so Eve, and this is Boyce's argument. I wouldn't necessarily follow him in the creation account, but here he's quite good. He says that what Eve expects is that Cain is the fulfillment of the promise in 3:15 for a Messiah.
Oh, wow.
And so Cain is raised with this expectation that he's going to be the deliverer. And then along comes little brother. And guess what? Satan comes after the supposed deliverer, and he turns into a murderer. And then, you know, we're left without the good brother either, right? So everything falls apart. That's, by the way, why we get to Abel. And the statement at the end of chapter 4 about Abel is, or about Seth. Seth is born to replace Abel, whom Cain killed. And so you get a replacement. And so the godly line goes through Seth. So that's an interesting thing. But anyway, I wouldn't die on that hill. But so that's the setting. Cain and Abel, and they're in, somehow God had given instructions to Cain and Abel or to Adam and Eve regarding the worship that's appropriate. They come at the appointed time, Genesis says, and they offer sacrifices, and one is acceptable and one isn't. And so in that, Cain is insanely jealous, and he comes after his brother and he kills him. And so it says, don't be like Cain, who was of the evil one and brutally murdered his brother. Verse 9, I think it is, in chapter 4. God says, Cain, why are you angry? He says, evil is crouching at the door, it desires to conquer you, but you must master it. And Cain doesn't. All right. His deeds were evil, but his brothers were righteous. Therefore, don't be surprised if the world hates you. We know that we've crossed over from death to life because we love our fellow Christians. And evidence of our faith is that we love our fellow Christians. The one who does not love remains in death. I should say evidence of our abiding. What does John mean by remains in death? So if John's talking to a believing audience, death and darkness are going to be metaphors for not abiding in Jesus, not walking with God. And so if the one who does not love remains in death, the significant part of that is there's only two options, right? Where's the I just don't care for that person option? Right? It's not there. You abide in love or you remain in death. So this is getting really uncomfortable. And honestly, it's so uncomfortable that I'm not going to say some of the stuff that I think John is saying, because it's just frankly too convicting, and I am not a good enough person to, you know, you're going to be held account for what you teach. So anyway, everyone who hates his fellow Christian is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. So maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, I don't really hate. I just strongly detest this person, right? I wouldn't say hate. That's fine. But verse 17 seems to define a little bit of what John talks about when he talks about love. You see somebody in need and you don't meet the need. That's the category of hatred. That's the category of murder. That's the category of darkness, the lack of love. So now this is really getting very, very uncomfortable, right? Now I have to do something differently. I can't just live as I choose to live. Suddenly, I've got these responsibilities if I really want to hear well done. And I really want to look forward to his return with joy. Everyone who hates his fellow Christian is a murderer. So this one, in chapter 2, we looked at if you don't do this stuff, if you don't love, then you're not abiding. If you must be loving in order to be abiding is what we're getting in chapter 3. Practical demonstration of love for believers is a practical demonstration of love for God. And I need to read this because it's kind of exact, so forgive me as I read. In this passage, John argues that love within the body of believers is a demonstration of love for God. For an individual to fail to express love for a believer is for that individual to fail to abide in relationship with God. John capitalizes on the gravity of hatred, equating it to murder, and murder is completely contradictory to the character of God. John has showed that hatred and murder are antithetical to God's presence or abiding in him. More than that, the world embodies hatred for God's people, and yet God's people embody his love. To fail to love is to fail to be in fellowship with God. But to love by living generously is to embody the love of God, to experience it and to express it. Further, loving others is an expression of loving God. It is important to note here that the actual love for the believer is not an expression of love for God directly. The other believer is not God. And that's the thing you really hear me say. I'm not saying panentheism, as we talked about earlier. Believers love other believers not because of who the beloved is, but because of what God has done in the life of the lover. One step of inference from the text proves the thesis of the chapter. John elsewhere has defined love for God as obedience. John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. If obedience to Jesus is loving him, and obedience as defined here in 1 John is to abide in and express the love of God to another believer, then loving other believers is loving God with God's love. All right, so we're almost to the point of making our thesis, or of proving it, I hope. And we come to our longest passage, which is the remainder of chapter 4. By this, the love of God is revealed in us, chapter 4, verse 9, that God sent his one and only Son into the world so that we may live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, if God so loved us, then we also ought to love one another. No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God resides in us and his love is perfected in us. Now, I need to pause there before I continue because the passage is long, so I just want to capitalize on that. What do you think it means when he says his love is perfected in us? Which is just another one of those very profound, amazing things.
Have to do with maturity.
I think so. But he's saying that perfected is another idea of perfected. The Greek word escapes me at the moment, but it's fill up, complete. I'll read a quote from Stott on this, John Stott. It would be hard to exaggerate the greatness of this conception. It is so daring that many commentators have been reluctant to accept it and have suggested that the genitive in his love is not subjective, God's love, but objective, our love for God. Or definitive, God-like love. But the whole paragraph is concerned with God's love, and we must not stagger at the majesty of this conclusion. God's love, which originates in himself and was manifested in his son, is made complete in his people. It is brought to perfection within us. God's love for us is perfected only when it is reproduced in us, or as it may seem, among us in the Christian fellowship. Let me read that second part again. God's love, which originates in himself and was manifested in his son, is made complete in his people. It is brought to perfection within us. God's love for us is perfected only when it is reproduced in us or among us in the Christian fellowship. So what that means, and this is, I get chills just thinking about this, right? What it means is that your role is so important that what God's love gets, in other words, you expressing love to the person next to you is supposed to be an expression of God's very love, so that that person next to you, their experience of the love of God is completed or filled. That is something, isn't it?
Staggering dimension.
Yeah. I mean, it would be enough if he died on the cross for us. It would be enough if he gave us his spirit. I mean, it'd be more than enough, right? It'd be beyond wonderful. But then the indwelling of the Spirit works in such a way that we express the very love so that someone else, their experience of God's love is complete through us. I tell you, that's happened to me many times, and more than I can count probably if I stop to think about it. But there are some amazing ways that's happened to me. And I just want to share one example, and I don't really have time to do it, but I'll do it anyway. I was a senior in college, and college's last 2 years were a rough time, lonely and poor. And the church I attended, 40 people on a good Sunday. The pastor was the drummer as well as the pastor. And anyway, they knew I was going to go to seminary when I graduated, and they said, "Hey, would you preach the Easter Sunday message this year? It's my last year." And I said, "I never preached before in my life. This is unbelievable. How in the world would you ask me to do that? This Easter Sunday, it's a big Sunday." And but there was spring break prior to Easter Sunday, and so I went back to Dallas. And before I went back to Dallas, I had an old beat up Mazda pickup truck, and I had that at school, and I had paid $700 for it. And I sold it to somebody for $600 in Santa Fe, and I went back to Dallas. We're in Dallas. And I had a 1969 International Scout that had been a project vehicle of mine for years. And I went back, and I was going to fix the Scout up, and in a moment of triumph, drive it back to school, because all my friends knew about my Scout. I loved my Scout. I still love Scouts. I talked about my Scout. And so, anyway, I went back, and I worked all that week on this sermon and on the Scout. Problem was, I couldn't get the brakes to work. It was an old brake system. I was going to plumbing stores trying to find fittings to hook the brake lines up to the master cylinder, and it was just a mess, and I couldn't get it going. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday night, and I'm in Dallas, and I have to preach, I think, at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. It's an 11-hour drive, and my mom finally says, "Listen, you just need to take my car and you need to drive out there." So I drive through the night. I get to Santa Fe at about 6 in the morning. I think I sleep for 2 hours. I get up at 8, and I guess service was at 9 or something, and I put a little more thought in, and I drive there. And I'm bug-eyed, right? I've driven all through the night. And incredible questions for God on, you know, my failure. This was supposed to be my moment. So as a young man, this stuff was really important to me. I guess it probably still is. I don't know. But anyway, so I get there and I have my sermon, and, I'm just broken over this thing not working. And here I am in my mother's car, and she's without a vehicle. And, you know, I just feel horrible about myself. And why in the world am I preaching? I mean, I just felt as bad as I've ever felt. And so anyway, I preached a sermon. And in the sermon, I used the illustration of this Scout not working and something about the grace of God and it overcomes our brokenness or something. I don't remember. Actually, I found when we were moving the notes to that sermon, which was like, this is crazy. Anyway, at the end of the sermon, the pastor comes up. He says, God spoke to me during your message. And I thought, whoa, this must have been a great message. It must have been really good. And, you know, this is high compliments. And then he said, I leaned over to my wife, and she said, God said the same thing to her. So I'm thinking to myself, boy, this is, you know, maybe I'm supposed to go to seminary after all. And so then he said, and God told us we're supposed to give you our car. And it was this, you know, taking, like, and they had a Toyota Corolla. It was beautiful shape, you know, perfect for what I needed. And it was just out of the blue, one of those things. They had it for sale. It was worth thousands of dollars. And so it was one of those moments where God's love through his people was made complete. And I was just a puddle. And that lasted long. I mean, the rest of that semester, just overwhelmed with the goodness of God. We fill up the love of God in another person's life as we demonstrate his love in us. Now, we have a role in completing the love of God is an earth-shattering claim. John here is writing that by loving God's people, we love him. We should not hesitate to describe love for a fellow believer as love for God. What must be understood in this statement is a clear orthodox understanding of God. What is not being said is that the other person is God, or even that we have to love the other person is, but simply that loving others is a direct demonstration of love for God. To love others is to love God. All right, come back to our text. We'll continue from verse 12. By this we know that we reside in God and he in us, in that he has given us of his Spirit. And we have seen and testify that the Father has sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. If anyone confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God resides in him and he in God. We've come to know and believe that God, the love that God has in us. God is love. And the one who resides in love resides in God, and God resides in him. All right, you can't get much clearer a statement of the connectedness, and it's so connected by the end of this passage, I'm going to say it's one, the connectedness between abiding in God and abiding in love for his people. Right? And we have come to know and believe the love that God has in us. God is love, and the one who resides in love resides in God. Right? And God resides in him. Okay? John's pretty tight. By this love is perfected in us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because just as Jesus is, so also are we in this world. You get back to the idea of the key verse, John 2:28, confidence in the day of judgment, right? The idea of abiding. There's no fear in love, but perfect love drives fear out, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears punishment has not been perfected in love. I have comments on that, but I'll skip them. We love because he loved us first. Verse 20, if anyone says, I love God, and yet hates his fellow Christian, he is a liar, because the one who does not love his fellow Christian whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Now, that's really, really important. The idea is you can't see God, but you can see another Christian, and God resides in that other Christian. And if you're having a hard time loving the Christian that you can see, there is no way on this earth that you actually love the God who created him or redeemed him or her. Does that make sense? And the commandment we have from him is this, that the one who loves God should love his fellow Christian too. Jesus' command to his followers, so this is about verse 20, especially as recorded in the fourth gospel, is unavoidable. Love is the initiating cause of Christianity and the sine qua non of the practice of following Jesus. There's a commentator by the name of Aiken in his commentary for 2nd and 3rd John. He makes this statement. The reason that it is impossible for the inconsistency stated in 420, remember that, okay, what's 420 saying again? I want to read it to you. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his fellow Christian, he is a liar, because the one who does not love his fellow Christian whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. All right, so claiming to love people or hating people and claiming to love God. The reason that it is impossible for the inconsistency stated in 4:20 to remain is that the command to love God and the command to love one's brother are two parts of one command. The command to love one's brother and the command to love God are two parts of one command. They are inseparable. In fact, the use of and or chi to begin the verse connects it with the prior verse. The inseparability of love for God and love for people must not be overlooked as one of, or perhaps the most, essential combinations of the inner relationship with God and its external demonstration. The significance of loving people as a reflection of one's relationship with God is not made only in John's writing. Paul wrote in Galatians 5:14, "For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus himself combines the same two elements in Mark 12:30-31, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." Loving believers is the perfecting of God's love in us. And that's abiding, abiding in fellowship with God is abiding in his experience and expressed love. These are points that I'm making. One, loving believers is the perfecting of God's love in us from verse 12. Point two, abiding in fellowship with God is abiding in his experience and expressed love. And that's from verse 16. Loving God and others is a response to God's initiatory love and indwelling. And four, the claim to love God can and should be validated in a believer's life by quantifiable efforts to meet the needs of believers in want. What can be distilled from these statements is the principle believers can pursue greater intimacy with God by loving other believers. If the failure to love believers is a failure to love God, and if loving other believers is an act of loving God, and if loving God cannot be separated from loving believers, and if loving God is the great commandment, then, as Smalley stated, we are to love God in others and others in him. Such is the meaning of living in love. Believers can pursue an active path of loving each other as a means to spiritual growth. Such a plan will doubtless lead them to the end of their natural affections for one another and into the supernatural love of God. Another statement from Smalley sums this up well. By loving other people, we are indeed loving him. Okay, so that's the concluding thought. I want to just say a couple of closing comments on this. I think why this is so important is that people are very hard to love. I have a 3-year-old little Annabelle, and she's adorable and a lot of fun. And she's the life of the party. Easy to love little Annabelle, right? David loves Annabelle. But, man, there's some people where that's not the case. And soon Annabelle will be a teenager. And I hear that that's a horrible experience for parents. But loving people is not an easy thing to do. In fact, I think it's a divine thing to do. And I wouldn't say that you should work at loving somebody and that as you do that, that you will grow spiritually. It's more complicated than that for sure. But I do think that it's one of those things that if you're thinking about seeing Jesus and having confidence in that day, and you go through the list of people in your life, and there are some people who, man, there's no love for that one. I think that that should cause you some concern. And I think you should think about it. And I think you should take it before Jesus. And, boy, the message this morning on the Assyrians was tough, wasn't it? Because, boy, there's some people I would like some judgment for, right? Again, I'll leave it to you to talk about unbelievers or to think through that, but certainly within the realm of the church, we've got enough examples that that can be really tough. That can be really tough. I can't be the same person and love some people. I have to be something different. Okay, that's my talk. Any questions? David.
Yeah. So is there a difference, or help me clarify my mind, is there a difference between hatred and anger? And I think I'm referencing Matthew 5 when Jesus says, if you have hatred in your heart, or no, he says, if you have anger in your heart, mm-hmm. you're committing murder. and mm-hmm. your worship with God is compromised, and therefore go reconcile with people and before you come back to the altar. Is there a difference between hatred and anger, or are they the same in Jesus' eyes?
So I definitely think, so not all, like there's the verse, be angry and don't sin. So I think that not all anger is hatred, but I do think that there's an easy connection between anger and hatred. I think it can happen super quickly. You know, what went through my head the last time I was cut off, right? I'm in Dallas traffic. Boy, that tests your sanctification, you know, when you're from the little rural area and you come down here and wow, yeah. So I don't think that anger is hatred automatically, but I do think that there's a connection that can be made between those, which we should be worried about. Yeah, anger is kind of a dangerous thing. Yeah.
Follow up. Can we as believers or disciples? Can we be angry at the violation of love?
Yeah, there's lots of times. So as a pastor, you know, you kind of hear some really rough stories. And so in listening to someone's story, I think there's a natural, sometimes if it's a natural response is that you're angry kind of for them. And you're angry about injustice and the things that have been done that have been wrong. So in a sense, there's this, I think there's an impersonal sort of anger that's out there. I think John's language is really personal though in 1 John. And so it's the person. You see that person and they need a pair of pants and you got one, you're not going to give it to them. Or they need a bowl of soup and you don't have it. So I think I would probably like to stay in the realm of the personal rather than the impersonal ideas about anger. I don't know what to do with that, frankly, but if there's a person that you can think of and you can see their face and know their name and you got that, then I think that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. What I think is interesting is how much love is talked about in the New Testament, all the way back through the Gospels, mm-hmm. Jesus' teaching, I mean, through the epistles, everywhere, love is talked about and really 1 John is the, you know, the chapter that, or the book that really speaks of it, but don't you think that Jesus knew how hard it was going to be to live this life, and if you didn't have love for each other, you didn't have anything. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that's where you see him, and that's what you were saying. Just, you know, it's so important. It's the most important thing, really, mm-hmm. in with other believers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think too the root with that too that he's guarding us against is bitterness, whereas mm-hmm. where that hatred and that anger lead to, you know, mm-hmm. that is what killed my late husband. My husband committed suicide 3.5 years ago, and I'm convinced that it was because of the anger and hatred that he had towards people that had harmed him at a young age and then throughout his life, and he couldn't let go of that, and it ate him up, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that God saw, you know, how big of an issue. I mean, you see that in secular counseling all the time. You know, like, you need to forgive for your own state of mind. Mm-hmm. And so I think that God knew how pivotal that was in our lives.
There's a verse in Hebrews 12:15. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. Bitterness is a big deal.
Yeah, and it's a daily, minute by minute, hour by hour.
Yes, it is.
Like, I have to guard myself against bitterness towards my late husband because he left me as a single mom and a big, huge mess to clean up with business and finances and, you know, everything else. And
so
I've recognized, I've seen how it ate him up, and I have to guard myself that it won't do the same for me. Not just against him, but against the people that harmed him, that, you know,
yeah.
That where he allowed that root of bitterness to grow in himself.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what it is. It's like a root. It's like a tree. It's going to spring up once he says, don't let that root take hold, because, boy, that's hard to deal with. And
And then you pass it on to your kids, and you mm-hmm. know, like, if my daughter sees my anger and bitterness towards her mm-hmm. dad, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. like, look what I've just done. Not only have I
yeah.
my own walk, my own fellowship with Christ, but now I've impacted hers.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a good word. Bitterness is, yeah, I think so often I find myself falling into an entitled mindset in relation to God. And I mean, I said that in the plenary talk. I said I got a lot of growing up to do, and it's true. things don't go your way. You think you've done what God wants you to do, and you've worked it out, and it turns south, and it's just and boy, bitterness comes in, and yeah, it's just a devastating thing. I'm by nature a very bitter person. I was born that way. Thank the Lord, He's done a lot of work in my life. I had all kinds of nicknames before I was even 5 years old about my bitter and angry disposition. But anyway, yeah, I know that story, and it doesn't end anywhere good. I wouldn't say the remedy, but kind of a practical thing. It's almost as though there's a requirement for a divine optimist mindset for the believer. Like, your story is ultimately good, and it's going to end in the presence of God, and it's eternally good. And when you live that way, and you live in light of the fact that you're so loved by God, and all of these things, when you start reflecting on these truths, things can be really awful, but at the same time, you can still have joy, and you can still have a positive, my wife's a great example of an optimist. You can still have that. Paul and Silas singing after they're beaten, singing praises to God. But yeah. Any other questions? I thought I had half an hour, but
yeah, three minutes.
Okay. Did I? Maybe I should have said more. I had 37 pages that I tried to condense into.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why did you write your paper on First John and the love of the believers?
So, thank you for asking that. That's a very insightful question, and I hope I have a sufficient answer. My story of my relationship with the Lord was one where I started out with a lot more knowledge about God than love for Him. I can remember getting into debates with adults about eschatology at the age of 12. I was disrespectful and mean-spirited, and so then, you know, I've been a pastor, and I've learned a lot about the Bible and a lot about God. But I think the people who knew a lot about the Bible knew a lot about God killed Jesus. And so that's really alarming. And so you start to think about that, and that's kind of scary. Wait a second. Because it's really easy to just indulge in and invest in and make your life about what you know and all these intricacies that no one else has seen, and this theologian and that, and this particulars of the language or whatever it is, and you can sound really spiritual, and you can fool a lot of people, and everyone can be impressed. But I don't know about when Jesus comes back, if all that matters to Him all that much. And so, in a very real sense, I think that if you know more than you love, then you're kind of a bad person, and that's not good at all. That's a real dangerous situation. And so the importance of loving people is not just an act of obedience. And so I felt that, and it's like, you know what, I want to love people. And John, I didn't make the point, but John is addressing some false teachers in the Gospel of John. And it seems like what he's saying is, if they don't love well, you know that there's a problem with them. Oh man, I'm a pastor, and everything's got to stop now. I got to take a step back. So I want to personally hear well done, and I'm really committed or convinced that means I really have to love people well, and I got to keep up my finger on my pulse of how my love is, because if it's failing, then I'm in trouble. And so that was the idea. It hopefully will eventually be a workbook and a book that will come out, and it'll be like a Bible study, like a 12-week thing to work through. with a group of people, and really just practical expressions of love in that context. So just the other side of let's approach intimacy with God from the practical side of love rather than the intellectual side of knowledge. And I think within my circle, within my background, that was lacking. Your maturity was measured by how much you knew. And so I thought that was a problem. So I wanted to address that. Yeah. All right. Well, that's what I got. Thank you, guys. Thank you.